The music at a London ballroom doesn't exist for dancing. It exists to cover the sound of commerce. Flesh titles, dowries, and bloodlines traded over the scrape of a cello, and the suffocating scent of hot wax and desperation. Clara knew the price of everything in the room, especially herself. Nothing. She was the forgotten sister, the permanent fixture by the ferns. So when the Duke of Ashbourne, a man known for freezing out prime ministers, bypassed a sea of silk and extended his white-gloved hand directly to her, the music didn't just fade. It died. There is a specific corner in every ballroom in London. It is always near the draughts, usually flanked by a dying potted palm, and entirely devoid of good lighting. Clara Hayes knew this corner intimately. She could tell you the exact species of the fern brushing her shoulder at the Harford estate, and she could tell you precisely how long it had been unwatered. 3 days, judging by the brittle yellow of the fronds. "Stand up straight, Penelope. You look like a frightened pigeon." Mrs. Hayes's voice was a harsh hiss, cutting through the low murmur of the arriving guests. Clara watched her mother dig a rigid finger into the base of her younger sister's spine. Penelope flinched, her porcelain face tightening as she forced her shoulders back. The movement made the intricate lace of her bodice strain. She looked beautiful. She looked terrified. "I'm trying, Mama," Penelope whispered. Her hands, hidden in the folds of her pale pink skirt, were trembling. Clara shifted her weight, ignoring the sharp pinch of her right shoe. "Leave her be, Mother. She's breathing, which is more than can be said for Lady Genevieve over there. I think her corset just fractured a rib." Mrs. Hayes shot Clara a look that could curdle milk. "Do not speak of your betters, Clara, and certainly do not do it with that tone. If you cannot be useful, at least be invisible." Clara didn't argue. Being invisible was her only marketable skill. At 23, she was firmly on the shelf, a dusty volume no one had bothered to check out. She wasn't ugly, but she wasn't a spectacle. She had mud-brown hair that refused to hold a curl, eyes the color of weak tea, and a face that was entirely forgettable. In the grand meat market of the London season, she was the gristle. Penelope at 18 was the prime cut. Golden hair, sky-blue eyes, and a dowry that their father had bankrupted the family estate to scrape together. Clara stepped back, letting the shadows of the alcove swallow her olive-green dress. The colour had been her mother's choice, a cheap, muddy fabric bought on discount, to ensure every spare shilling went to Penelope's wardrobe. Clara didn't mind. The green blended perfectly with the dying palm. The ballroom was filling up. It smelled of spilled champagne, heavy lavender perfume, and the faint, sour tang of nervous sweat. Clara leaned against the cold plaster wall and watched the machinery of the room turn. She saw Lord Danvers cornering a young debutante near the punch bowl, his eyes darting to her chest, while her mother watched approvingly from 10 feet away. She saw the dowagers sitting like vultures on the velvet settees, their fans snapping in time with their vicious judgments. It was a brutal ecosystem. Eat or be eaten. Marry well or die in genteel poverty. Penelope caught Clara's eye through the crowd. The younger girl looked frantic, a small trapped animal surrounded by hungry wolves in tailcoats. Clara offered a slight grounding nod. "Breathe," she mouthed. Penelope took a shaky breath and turned back to the young heir her mother was shoving her toward. Clara closed her eyes. The noise of the room, the forced laughter, the scraping of leather shoes on polished wood, the relentless, aggressively cheerful string quartet was giving her a migraine. She reached behind the palm, found a half-empty glass of lemonade, left on a windowsill by a careless footman, and picked it up. It was warm and tasted mostly of melted ice, but it coated her dry throat. If he doesn't find a wife this season, the line ends with him. Can you imagine? A voice drifted from the other side of the ferns. Two matrons were whispering furiously, their feathered turbans nearly colliding. "I heard he shot his own horse because it threw him," the second woman replied. "Ruthless, completely heartless, but 80,000 a year." 80,000, the first breathed the number hanging in the air like a prayer. A girl could forgive a lot of heartlessness for 80,000. Clara took another sip of her warm lemonade. £80,000. It was a number so large it lost all meaning. It didn't buy comfort. It bought small countries. A sudden sharp silence rolled over the room. It didn't happen all at once. It started at the grand double doors and rippled outward, snuffing out conversations like a drafted candle. The string quartet faltered, the cellist missing a beat, before hastily picking up the tempo again. Clara opened her eyes and looked towards the entrance. Arthur Westing, the Duke of Ashbourne, did not enter a room. He happened to it. He stood at the top of the grand staircase, looking down at the sea of London's finest, as if he had just scraped them off the bottom of his boot. He was 30 years old, but the deep lines bracketing his mouth and the cold, flat stare of his pale grey eyes belonged to a man who had seen a century of disappointments. Clara watched him from her shadowed corner. He wasn't classically handsome. His jaw was too sharp. His nose bore the faint crook of a long-heeled brake, and his dark hair was clipped severely short, devoid of the fashionable pomade favoured by the dandies in the room. He wore stark black evening wear, no gold fobs, no embroidered waistcoats, just black wool white linen, and an aura of absolute crushing authority. "Good God," Mrs. Hayes whispered, her voice trembling with sudden violent ambition. She grabbed Penelope by the elbow and hauled her forward. "Stand up, girl. Pinch your cheeks. He's here." Clara didn't move. She watched Ashbourne descend the stairs. Every step was deliberate, unhurried. The crowd parted for him instinctively, creating a wide, desperate aisle. He didn't acknowledge them. He didn't nod to the bowing lords or the curtsying ladies. He looked bored, deeply, fundamentally bored. He reached the floor, and Lord Harford, the host, practically threw himself at the Duke's feet. "Your grace, an honour. Truly an honour." Harford sputtered, sweating profusely into his cravat. Ashbourne stopped. He looked at Harford. He didn't smile. "Harford, the roads were appalling. Tell your councilman to pave the stretch past Mayfair, or I'll stop funding the borough." His voice carried. It was low, rich, and entirely devoid of warmth. It didn't hold the affected drawl of the aristocracy. It sounded like business. Harford swallowed hard. "Yes, Your Grace. Of course, Your Grace. May I introduce you to some of the season's finest?" He gestured vaguely toward a cluster of women that included a hyperventilating Penelope and a perfectly posed Lady Genevieve. Ashbourne's eyes swept over the group. Clara watched his gaze. It was clinical. He wasn't looking at women. He was looking at livestock. He noted Genevieve's calculating smile. He noted Penelope's terror. He looked past them both, his eyes tracking the perimeter of the room. "He's looking for the exits." Clara thought a sudden, surprising bark of a laugh catching in her chest. She stifled it into her lemonade glass, but the movement, a slight jolt in the shadows, caught his attention. For a fraction of a second, the Duke of Ashbourne looked directly at the potted palm. Clara froze. She held the warm glass against her chest, the muddy green of her dress blending into the leaves. His pale grey eyes locked onto her face. There was no spark of attraction, no sudden realization of her hidden beauty. He simply saw her. He saw a tired woman in an ugly dress, hiding behind a dying plant, drinking abandoned lemonade. Clara didn't look away. She was too tired to be intimidated. She stared back, her expression flat, offering him the exact same clinical assessment he had given the room. "You are miserable, her eyes said. And so am I. The corner of his mouth twitched. It wasn't a smile. It was barely a tremor. But the severe frozen mask of his face cracked just for a millimeter. Then he turned away. I am not here to inspect the merchandise, Harford. Ashbourne said loudly, his voice slicing through the heavy, expectant silence of the room. A collective gasp rippled through the mothers. I am here because I promised my sister I would make an appearance. Consider the appearance made. But Your Grace, Harford stammered, desperate to salvage the coup of having the Duke at his ball. The first dance is about to begin. It is tradition for the highest-ranking peer to lead the floor. Surely, surely you will honour us with a waltz. Ashbourne stopped. He slowly turned his head back to Harford. The room held its breath. If he danced, it meant he was looking. If he danced, the bloodbath would officially begin. A waltz, Ashbourne repeated. The word sounded like a curse in his mouth. He looked at the sea of eager faces. He looked at Mrs. Hayes, who was practically shoving Penelope into the center aisle. He looked at the frantic, grasping desperation of 100 people who wanted a piece of his $80,000 a year. And then his pale eyes drifted past them all. They traveled back to the draughty corner, back to the yellowing ferns. Very well, the Duke said softly. A waltz. The orchestra scrambled to their seats. The conductor raised his baton with trembling hands. The floor cleared instantly. No one dared step onto the polished wood until the Duke had made his choice. The silence in the room was no longer expectant. It was predatory. Mrs. Hayes dug her nails into Penelope's arm. Smile, she hissed. Look at him. Ashbourne adjusted his left cuff. He did not look at Penelope. He did not look at Lady Genevieve, who had perfectly angled her chin to catch the chandelier light. He began to walk. His boots struck the floor in a slow, rhythmic cadence. Clack, clack, clack. He passed the punch bowl. He passed the dowagers. He walked directly towards the right side of the ballroom, toward the shadows. Clara watched him come. Her brain, usually so sharp, so practical, simply stopped functioning. She watched the tall, dark figure part the crowd, like a ship cutting through dark water. He was walking towards the alcove. He's going to the smoking room, Clara thought wildly. There must be a door behind me. I'm blocking the door. She pressed her back harder against the cold plaster wall, trying to fuse with it. She dropped her gaze to the floor, waiting for him to pass. She waited for the scent of sandalwood and cold air to brush by her. The heavy black boots stopped exactly 3 inches from her scuffed, painful right shoe. Clara blinked at the polished leather. She didn't move. Are you going to look up, or shall we conduct this entire conversation staring at our footwear? The voice was directly above her. It was quiet, meant only for her, and devoid of any polite warmth. Clara slowly raised her head. The Duke of Ashbourne was standing so close she could see the faint, silvery scar cutting through his left eyebrow. His face was a hard, immovable wall. Your Grace, Clara whispered. It was the only thing she could think to say. You are hiding, he stated. It wasn't a question. I am standing. You are wearing a colour found only in swamps, standing behind a deceased plant, drinking someone else's discarded beverage. He looked at the glass in her hand. You are hiding. Clara felt a sudden sharp spike of irritation pierce through her shock. She didn't care who he was. She was exhausted, her feet bled, and she was not going to be mocked by a man who had 50 servants to chew his food for him. It is a very good plant, Your Grace. Clara said, her voice flattening into a dry monotone. And the beverage is mine. Now, if you'll excuse me, you are blocking the draught. It was the only thing keeping me awake. She expected him to scoff. She expected him to turn on his heel and leave her to her obscurity. Instead, Ashbourne held out his hand. White kid leather, long, strong fingers, palm facing up. Clara stared at his hand as if it were a loaded pistol. The silence in the ballroom was total. The music had not started. 150 pairs of eyes were locked onto the dark corner. Clara could feel the heat of their stares, a physical pressure pressing against her skin. She heard a sharp, strangled noise from across the room. It sounded like her mother choking. "What are you doing?" Clara whispered, panic finally slicing into her chest. "Fulfilling an obligation," Ashbourne replied. His eyes didn't leave hers. They were incredibly cold, yet burning with an intense, calculated defiance. "If I dance with the golden-haired child, shaking like a leaf to your left, I will have a marriage contract thrust into my hands by midnight. If I dance with the brunette, calculating her angles by the pillar, I will spend the next 10 minutes listening to her compliment my estates." He stepped half an inch closer. "But you," he said softly, "you looked at me as though you wished I would spontaneously combust so you could go home." Clara swallowed hard. "I don't dance." "You have feet. You know the steps. You are making a spectacle of me." "I am saving myself from a firing squad. Consider this a humanitarian effort." His hand remained outstretched, unwavering. "Take my hand, madam, before Harford spontaneously apoplexes and ruins my boots." Clara looked at his hand. She looked at his face. He wasn't doing this to be kind. He wasn't a fairy tale prince rescuing Cinderella. He was a cynical, exhausted man using her as a human shield against a room full of predators. She understood that. She respected that. With a shaking hand, Clara set her warm lemonade down on the windowsill. She wiped her clammy palm on the skirt of her swamp green dress, and she placed her hand in his. His fingers closed around hers. His grip was firm, warm, and entirely grounding. "What is your name?" he asked as he pulled her effortlessly from the shadows. "Clara. Clara Hayes." "Well, Clara Hayes," Ashbourne said, turning toward the center of the completely silent, paralyzed ballroom. "Let us go ruin some evenings." He didn't lead her to the floor. He marched her there. Clara's cheap shoes scraped against the wood. She could feel the collective shock of the room breaking over her like a physical wave. Lady Genevieve looked as though she had been struck by lightning. Mrs. Hayes was gripping a chair back so hard her knuckles were white, her mouth opening and closing like a landed trout. They reached the center of the floor. Ashbourne turned to her. He placed his right hand firmly on the small of her waist, right over the cheap, stiff fabric of her gown. The heat of his palm sank instantly into her skin. He looked at the conductor and gave a single sharp nod. The conductor jumped, nearly dropping his baton, and frantically signaled the quartet. The sweeping, mournful notes of a Viennese waltz ripped through the silence. Ashbourne stepped forward, pulling Clara with him. She stumbled on the first step. Her left foot caught on the hem of her too long dress. She braced herself for the humiliation, for the sneers of the crowd. But Ashbourne's arm tightened around her waist. He didn't let her fall. He simply absorbed her misstep, adjusted his own stride, and physically carried her through the next turn. "Breathe, Clara," he muttered, his jaw tight as they spun past a group of gaping lords. "You are stiff as a board." "I told you I don't dance," she snapped back, staring fixedly at the black wool of his lapel to avoid looking at the crowd. "You don't have to. Just don't fight me. Follow my momentum." He stepped back, drawing her into a sweeping arc. Clara had no choice but to follow. He was stronger than he looked, and he danced with the same ruthless efficiency with which he spoke. There was no joy in his movements, only precision. but it was a flawless precision. As they turned, the room became a blur of shocked faces and glittering chandeliers. The initial terror in Clara's chest began to subside, replaced by a strange, numb disbelief. She, Clara Hayes, the wallflower. The gristle was dancing with the Duke of Ashbourne. "They are staring," Clara whispered, her grip tightening nervously on his shoulder. "Let them," Ashbourne said dismissively. "My mother is going to have a seizure." Ashbourne glanced over her head, spotting Mrs. Hayes's apoplectic face in the crowd. "She appears robust enough to survive it, though I recommend staying out of her reach for at least an hour after this ends." Clara looked up at him in surprise. A short, involuntary breath of laughter escaped her lips. Ashbourne looked down at her, his cold grey eyes locked onto her face again. The harsh lines around his mouth softened just a fraction. "Better," he murmured. The music swelled, the cellos digging deep into the melody. The other couples, finally recovering from their shock, began to tentatively join the floor, desperate to share the space with the Duke. But they kept a wide berth. Ashbourne and Clara moved in a bubble of untouchable isolation. "Why me?" Clara asked the question, slipping out before she could stop it. "Truly, you could have picked anyone. You could have stood in the corner yourself. I told you, you were the only person in this room who didn't look at me like a meal." He expertly steered her around a clumsy pair of dancers. "Besides, I dislike bullies." Clara frowned. "Who is bullying you?" "Not me, you." Ashbourne's eyes flicked to her face. "I heard your mother speaking to you before I came down the stairs, about being invisible." Clara stiffened her spine, going rigid under his hand. A hot flush of deep, ugly shame crept up her neck. He had heard that. The most powerful man in the room had heard her own mother call her useless. "That is none of your concern," Clara said, her voice dropping to a harsh whisper. She tried to pull back, but his hand clamped firmly on her waist, refusing to let her retreat. "It isn't," Ashbourne agreed smoothly. "But I have found that the best way to punish people who demand visibility is to give it to someone they deem unworthy of it." He pulled her closer, his head dipping so his mouth was near her ear. The scent of him, clean wool, cold air, and something sharp and metallic filled her senses. For the next 3 minutes, Clara Hayes, the Duke of Ashbourne whispered, his voice vibrating against her skin. "You are the most visible woman in England. Use it." The music did not fade. The final chord severed the air like a butcher's cleaver. Ashbourne stopped moving. He dropped Clara's waist and released her hand in one fluid motion, instantly restoring the physical boundary between them. He did not linger. He did not offer a warm parting smile. He simply took a single step back and delivered a crisp, mechanical bow. "Miss Hayes," he said, his voice carrying just enough to reach the ring of eavesdroppers closing in on them. A passable effort, he turned on his heel and walked away. The crowd parted for him again, but this time they were buzzing frantic, their eyes darting between his retreating back and the woman he had left standing in the center of the floor. Clara stood perfectly still. Her legs felt hollow. Her right foot throbbed where the cheap leather of her shoe pinched against the bone. She looked down at her hands. They were trembling, the skin flushed and warm, where his fingers had gripped hers. "You are the most visible woman in England. Use it." The words echoed in her skull. She didn't know how to use it. She didn't have a weapon. She only had a target painted squarely on her chest. Before she could retreat to her shadows, a hand clamped onto her bicep. The grip was a vice, the fingernails biting sharply through the thin fabric of her sleeve. "Walk," Mrs. Hayes hissed in her ear. Clara didn't argue. She let her mother drag her through the whispering crowd. She saw Lady Genevieve glaring at her with a hatred so pure it was almost religious. She saw Penelope trailing behind them, looking confused and slightly nauseous. They reached the cloakroom. Mrs. Hayes didn't wait for the attendant. She yanked Clara's faded woolen shawl from a hook and practically threw it at her face. "What did you say to him?" Mrs. Hayes's voice was a low, vibrating tremor. Her face was entirely devoid of colour. "Nothing," Clara said, pulling the shawl tightly around her shoulders to hide her shaking hands. "He asked my name." "Do not lie to me, Clara." Mrs. Hayes backed her into the heavy oak door of the coat room. "Men like the Duke of Ashbourne do not pluck spinsters from the ferns unless provoked. Did you spill something on him? Did you insult him? He asked me to dance, Mother. That is all." Mrs. Hayes studied her eldest daughter. Her eyes raked over Clara's dull brown hair, her unremarkable face, the muddy green dress that hung terribly at the waist. Her expression twisted into a mixture of disgust and profound realization. "He is using you," Mrs. Hayes concluded softly. The panic left her voice replaced by cold, calculating logic. "He saw the trap Harford set with those debutantes. He saw me pushing Penelope. He chose you because you are a non-entity. You are a shield, a way to dance without committing to a courtship." Clara swallowed the dry lump in her throat. Her mother was right. It was exactly what Ashbourne had told her. Yet hearing it weaponized by the woman who had given birth to her felt like a slow twist of a dull knife. "Yes," Clara said flatly. "That is exactly what he did." Mrs. Hayes straightened her posture, regaining its rigid authority. "Fine. If the Duke wishes to play games, we will play them. You have his attention, Clara, even as a shield. You will use that proximity. You will ensure he sees Penelope. Do you understand me?" Clara looked past her mother, catching Penelope's eye. The young girl was biting her lip, her blue eyes wide with nervous tears. Penelope didn't want the Duke. She was terrified of him. "I understand," Clara said. The Hayes family rented a narrow, drafty townhouse on the wrong side of Mayfair. It smelled perpetually of boiled cabbage and old dust. The wallpaper in the morning room was peeling near the skirting boards, a constant reminder of the debt their father had left behind when he drank himself to death 4 years ago. Clara sat at the small mahogany table, staring at a piece of dry toast. It was 9 in the morning, 2 days after the Harford ball. The social atmosphere of London had shifted entirely. Before the ball, Clara had been a ghost. Now she was an anomaly. Yesterday, 3 different dowagers had accidentally crossed paths with her while she walked the meagre distance to the modiste. They hadn't spoken to her, but they had stared. Hard, calculating stares, trying to find the secret, the hidden leverage she held over the Westing fortune. "Sit up, Penelope. Your posture is atrocious," Mrs. Hayes barked from the window. She was peering through the crack in the heavy drapes, watching the street. "If a caller arrives, I will not have you looking like a melted candle." "No one is calling Mama," Penelope said, miserably picking at her own toast. "Lord Danvers hasn't sent flowers. Mr. Higgins hasn't ridden by. The Duke scared them all away." "The Duke established the baseline," Mrs. Hayes corrected sharply. "If Ashbourne is looking at our family, the lesser lords will wait to see what he does before making a move. It is a temporary drought. When Ashbourne inevitably moves on, the others will return desperate for a scrap of his discarded interest." Clara took a sip of her weak, lukewarm tea. Her mother's understanding of social economics was terrifyingly accurate. A heavy knock echoed through the quiet house. Mrs. Hayes froze. Penelope gasped. Clara simply set her teacup down. A moment later, their single, overworked maid shuffled into the dining room. She was holding a small silver tray. On it rested a thick, cream-coloured envelope. "For Miss Clara, ma'am," the maid said, looking terrified. Mrs. Hayes snatched the envelope from the tray before Clara could even move. She broke the heavy wax seal, stamped with a roaring lion, and pulled out a stiff card. Her eyes darted over the heavy black script. Silence stretched. The only sound was the ticking of the mantel clock. "Mother," Penelope whispered. Mrs. Hayes slowly lowered the card. She looked at Clara. It wasn't a look of maternal pride. It was a look of profound, bewildered resentment. "Lady Louisa Westing," Mrs. Hayes said slowly, "sister to the Duke of Ashbourne requests the pleasure of Miss Clara Hayes's company for a promenade in St. James's Park at 2 o'clock today." Clara felt the blood drain from her face. "Me?" "Yes, you." Mrs. Hayes tossed the card onto the table. It slid across the polished wood and stopped against Clara's plate. "It specifically names you." "Why?" Penelope asked, genuinely bewildered. Mrs. Hayes began to pace. Her mind was working frantically, weaving this new data into her strategy. "Because it is improper for a duke to call upon a spinster without a chaperone. He is using his sister. It is a screen." She stopped and pointed a rigid finger at Clara. "He is trying to keep his shield close, but he has made a tactical error. He has invited you out into the open." Clara stared at the heavy black ink of her own name. "Miss Clara Hayes. Where the blue police?" Mrs. Hayes commanded her voice, dropping into a general's cadence. "It is old, but it is clean. Penelope, you will wear the yellow silk, the one with the ribbons." "Penelope wasn't invited." Clara pointed out her voice, surprisingly steady, despite the rapid pounding of her heart. "Penelope is your sister. You cannot possibly walk in the park without her." Mrs. Hayes snapped. "The Duke will be there. His sister is merely the excuse. When he approaches you, will curtsy. You will answer him briefly, and then you will step back. You will let him see Penelope in the sunlight. You will not monopolize the conversation." "Am I understood?" Clara looked at the peeling wallpaper. She thought of Ashbourne's cold grey eyes. She thought of his absolute disdain for the rules her mother worshipped. "Use it." "Yes, mother," Clara said. St. James's Park was bathed in a brittle, pale afternoon sunlight. The air was crisp, biting through the thin, worn wool of Clara's blue pelisse. Beside her, Penelope looked like a walking daffodil in bright yellow silk, her teeth chattering slightly in the cold. Mrs. Hayes trailed 5 paces behind them, maintaining the illusion of a leisurely family stroll while scanning the gravel paths with the intensity of a sniper. "I feel ridiculous," Penelope muttered, clutching her matching yellow parasol like a shield. "Everyone is looking at us." "They are looking at the pelicans, Pen," Clara lied. "They weren't looking at the pelicans. The park was crowded with the ton, all executing their daily calculated promenades." When Clara and Penelope walked past, conversations dropped to hushed whispers. Women paused in their strolls, adjusting their bonnets, while openly staring at Clara. "There," Mrs. Hayes hissed from behind them. Clara stopped. Ahead of them, the crowd naturally parted near the edge of the lake. A tall, elegant woman with dark hair and a sharply intelligent face was standing by the water, tossing torn bread to a vicious-looking swan. She wore deep burgundy velvet. Beside her, sitting atop a massive, terrifyingly muscular black gelding, was the Duke of Ashbourne. He wasn't wearing riding leathers. He wore a dark grey coat that stretched tight across his broad shoulders, holding the reins with one gloved hand. He looked entirely relaxed and entirely lethal. "Keep your chin down, Penelope." "Smile softly," Mrs. Hayes ordered. "Clara, step forward and introduce us." Clara forced her legs to move. The gravel crunched loudly beneath her worn boots. She felt the heavy weight of Ashbourne's gaze latch onto her the moment she took her first step. He didn't look at Penelope. He didn't look at Mrs. Hayes. He watched Clara approach, his expression unreadable. Clara stopped 3 feet from his horse. She sank into a shallow, perfectly adequate curtsy. "Your Grace," Clara said. She turned to the woman in burgundy. "Lady Louisa, I am Clara Hayes. Thank you for your invitation." Lady Louisa dusted the breadcrumbs from her gloves and turned. Her eyes, the same pale grey as her brother's, swept over Clara. But unlike the Duke's, her eyes held a spark of deep, wicked amusement. "Miss Hayes," Louisa said, her voice warm but sharp. "Arthur told me you were pragmatic. Most women would have worn a new dress they couldn't afford for this meeting. You wore your oldest coat. I approve." Clara blinked, entirely thrown off balance by the bluntness. Behind her, she heard her mother suck in a sharp breath of horror. "It keeps the wind out, my lady," Clara managed to say. "A rare and useful quality in a coat," Ashbourne drawled from atop his horse. Clara looked up at him. The sunlight caught the silvery scar on his brow. "Miss Hayes," Ashbourne said, his voice dropping slightly in pitch. "The swamp green dress is missing. A pity. I felt it truly captured the essence of the Harford ballroom." "I had it burned, Your Grace," Clara replied evenly, ignoring the frantic poke of her mother's parasol against her lower back. "The ashes are currently fertilizing my mother's hydrangeas." The corner of Ashbourne's mouth twitched, that same millimeter-wide break in his armor. "May I present my mother, Mrs. Hayes, and my sister Penelope?" Clara said, stepping aside exactly as she had been ordered. Mrs. Hayes pushed past Clara, dragging Penelope forward. "Your Grace, Lady Louisa, we are entirely humbled by your attention. Penelope was just saying how beautiful the lake looks today. Weren't you, my dear?" Penelope squeaked something unintelligible. Ashbourne's eyes slid from Clara to Penelope. The faint amusement in his expression vanished instantly, replaced by the flat, bored mask he had worn at the ball. He looked at the girl in the yellow silk as if she were a moderately interesting piece of patio furniture. "Fascinating," Ashbourne said, deadpan. He shifted his gaze to Mrs. Hayes. "Mrs. Hayes, your eldest daughter and my sister are going to walk the perimeter of the lake. You and your youngest will remain here." Mrs. Hayes's smile froze. The calculation in her eyes short-circuited. I beg your pardon, Your Grace. It is hardly proper for Clara to walk unchaperoned." "My sister is a chaperone," Ashbourne interrupted smoothly. "She is a widow of 3 years and holds a rank high enough to dictate propriety rather than follow it." He pulled slightly on the reins, his massive horse stepping forward, forcing Mrs. Hayes to hastily retreat. "Unless you are accusing my sister of being an inadequate guardian of virtue, Mrs. Hayes." The threat was palpable. It hung in the cold air, wrapped in polite, aristocratic phrasing. "No, Your Grace, of course not." Mrs. Hayes stammered, her face flushing a deep, ugly red. She shot a look at Clara, a look of pure venom. "Fix this," the look demanded. "Give him back to Penelope." Clara looked at her mother. She looked at Penelope, who was staring at the ground, miserable and shivering. Then she looked up at Arthur Westing. He was watching her, waiting to see what she would do. He was testing her. He had given her visibility. Now he was giving her power. Clara took a slow, steadying breath. She stepped away from her mother and moved toward Lady Louisa. "Shall we, my lady?" Clara said, her voice ringing clear and steady over the gravel. "We shall," Louisa smiled. As Clara walked away, leaving her mother stranded and fuming by the water's edge, Ashbourne turned his horse to follow slowly behind them. For the first time in 23 years, Clara Hayes felt the dangerous, intoxicating heat of stepping directly into the light. The gravel of the serpentine path crunched in a steady, rhythmic grind beneath Clara's worn boots. Beside her, Lady Louisa walked with the effortless glide of a woman who had never known the pinch of second-hand leather. Behind them, the massive hooves of the Duke's gelding struck the earth like slow, deliberate drumbeats. For 5 minutes, no one spoke. The silence wasn't awkward. It was tactical. Clara could feel the eyes of the promenading Tun burning into her spine. She kept her gaze fixed straight ahead, watching the grey water of the lake lap against the muddy banks. "My brother," Louisa began her voice, low enough that the wind snatched the words before they could carry to the nearest eavesdropper, "is a remarkably stubborn creature, like a mule but with a better tailor." Clara glanced sideways. Louisa was smiling, but her pale eyes were assessing Clara with the sharpness of a diamond cutter. "I am beginning to gather that, my lady," Clara said cautiously, "Arthur does not do things by accident. He does not invite a woman to walk simply to annoy her mother, although I admit watching Mrs. Hayes's face turn the colour of a bruised plum was worth the chill in the air." Louisa stepped smoothly over a puddle. "He asked you to dance because he needed a wall. He brought you here today because he is realizing the wall has a foundation." Clara stopped. She didn't mean to, but her legs simply ceased functioning. Behind them, the horse stopped. Leather creaked. Heavy boots hit the gravel. "Louisa!" Arthur's voice came from directly behind Clara's left shoulder. "I did not ask you along to psychoanalyze me, to a woman who already wishes I were dead." "I don't wish you dead." "Your Grace," Clara said, staring straight ahead at a barren willow tree. "I simply wish you were less complicated." Arthur stepped beside her. Up close, without the shadows of the ballroom, the brutal lines of his face were even more pronounced. He looked tired. A deep, bone-weary exhaustion that £80,000 a year evidently could not cure. "Walk Clara," he ordered quietly. "If we stop, the vultures will descend. Lady Genevieve is currently hiding behind a statue of Achilles, pretending to adjust her parasol." Clara resumed walking. Arthur kept pace beside her, having handed the reins of his massive horse to a passing groomsman with a flick of a silver coin. Louisa, showing a remarkable amount of tact for a duchess's daughter, suddenly found the ducks near the water's edge utterly fascinating and drifted a dozen paces ahead. "Your mother will punish you for leaving her stranded by the lake," Arthur stated. It wasn't an apology. It was an observation of fact. "My mother punishes me for breathing too loudly, Your Grace. Stranding her is merely a variation on a theme." Clara pulled her thin pelisse tighter around her chest. The wind off the water was sharp. "What I want to know is why you are prolonging this. You made your point at the ball. You proved you cannot be cornered. So why the invitation today? Why are we walking?" Arthur looked at her. He didn't look at her mouth or her chest or the cheap trim of her bonnet. He looked directly into her weak tea-coloured eyes. "Because the ball was a temporary fix," Arthur said, his voice a low rumble over the crunching gravel. "I require a permanent one, at least for the duration of the season." Clara let out a harsh, bitter laugh. The sound startled a nearby pigeon. "A permanent fix? You want a fake courtship? I want a barricade, and you think I am desperate enough to play the part?" "I think you are intelligent enough to see the mutual benefit," Arthur countered smoothly. "You are 23, unmarried. Your father bankrupted your estate, and your mother uses you as a footstool while she tries to auction off your sister to the highest bidder." Clara stopped again, turning fully to face him. The cold wind whipped a stray lock of muddy brown hair across her cheek. "Do not speak of my family." Arthur stepped closer. He didn't flinch from her anger. He seemed to welcome it. "I will speak of whatever I choose, Clara, because I am the only person in London willing to speak the truth to you. You are drowning in that house. If you enter a public courtship with me, you become untouchable. Your mother will not dare speak a harsh word to you while she thinks there is a coronet within your reach. Your sister will be spared the immediate meat market, because the lesser lords will flock to her simply to be near me. And what do you get? Clara demanded, her chest heaving. What does the great Duke of Ashbourne get from parading a swamp monster around Hyde Park? I get peace. The word hung in the air, heavy and fragile. Arthur looked away, his gaze drifting out over the grey, choppy water of the Serpentine. For a fraction of a second, the iron mask slipped entirely. Clara saw the terrifying, crushing weight of his life. The endless parade of sycophants. The women who looked at him and saw nothing but a vault of gold. The mothers who would gladly trade their daughter's happiness for a title. If I am courting you. Arthur continued, his voice dropping to a harsh whisper. The rest of them will leave me be. I will not be hunted. I will not be cornered in smoking rooms by desperate fathers. I can simply exist. He turned back to her. The pale grey eyes were entirely clear. I will buy your time, Clara. I will elevate you. I will protect your sister from the wolves. And at the end of the season, we will agree that we are utterly incompatible and part ways. You will have the prestige of having rejected a duke, which will secure you a respectable, quiet match of your own choosing. And I will retreat to my estates in peace. It was a cold, calculated transaction. It was the most cynical thing Clara had ever heard. It was perfect. Clara looked at his gloved hand. She looked at his sharp jaw. She thought of the smell of boiled cabbage, the pinching shoes, and the terrified look in Penelope's eyes when Lord Danvers stared at her chest. You will not mock my clothes again, Clara said softly. A slow, devastatingly handsome smirk broke across Arthur's face. It changed his entirely. He looked 5 years younger. I make no promises about the clothes, Arthur said, but I will buy you a new coat. That one is a tragedy. Deal, Clara said. The illusion held for exactly 3 weeks. In that time, the social geography of London contorted itself to fit the bizarre reality of the Duke of Ashbourne's courtship of Clara Hayes. Invitations flooded the draughty townhouse. Clara, previously invisible, found herself seated at the right hand of hostesses, who a month ago wouldn't have trusted her to hold their coats. Arthur was ruthless in his execution. He called on her twice a week. He sent flowers, not the grand, ostentatious hothouse roses that screamed of new money, but quiet, rare clippings from his own country estate greenhouses. He rode beside their carriage. He was a silent, immovable presence that radiated pure threat to anyone who dared look at Clara with disdain. Mrs. Hayes was beside herself. She veered wildly between fawning terror of Clara and vicious, whispering resentment. Penelope, shielded by the blinding glare of Arthur's attention on Clara, found she could finally breathe. Young men still called, but carefully, politely terrified of offending the Duke's potential sister-in-law. It was working. It was a flawless, bloodless victory. Until the night of the opera. The Royal Opera House was a sweltering cage of velvet gaslight and heavily perfumed sweat. Clara sat in the front row of the Ashbourne box, wearing a new gown of deep midnight blue silk. Arthur had paid for it under the guise of his sister's generosity, and Clara had been too tired of freezing to argue. Arthur sat in the shadows at the back of the box, watching the crowd more than the stage. During the intermission, the crushing reality of their ruse finally fractured. Clara had stepped out into the carpeted corridor to escape the suffocating heat of the box. She stood by a marble pillar, sipping a glass of water, trying to ease the pounding in her temples. It really is a remarkable piece of theatre, isn't it? Clara turned, Lady Genevieve stood a few feet away, flanked by two other debutantes. Genevieve wore pale pink, her diamonds flashing viciously in the gaslight. Her smile was a razor blade, wrapped in silk. "The soprano is in fine voice," Clara replied evenly, keeping her face blank. "Oh, I didn't mean the soprano," Genevieve laughed a high, brittle sound. She stepped closer. "I meant you, Miss Hayes. It is a stunning performance, truly. We are all quite mesmerized." Clara gripped her water glass. "I don't know what you mean." "Of course you do." Genevieve dropped her voice to a harsh, conspiratorial whisper. "We all know he isn't going to marry you. He is using you to prove a point to the rest of us. He is punishing us for being obvious by elevating by elevating that." She gestured vaguely to Clara's face. "But the joke is wearing thin. He looks at you like you are a chore he must endure." Clara felt a cold prickle of sweat break out on the back of her neck. Genevieve wasn't entirely wrong. Arthur was using her. It was a business arrangement. But hearing it spoken out loud, spat at her with such casual cruelty, felt like a physical blow. Before Clara could form a response, another voice cut through the corridor. "Genevieve is right, Clara. It is time to stop this embarrassment." Clara whipped her head around. Her mother, Mrs. Hayes, was marching down the corridor, her face set in lines of righteous fury. She didn't lower her voice. She wanted the surrounding lords and ladies to hear. "Mother, what are you doing?" Clara hissed panic, finally seizing her throat. "I am saving our family's reputation," Mrs. Hayes declared loudly. The corridor went dead silent. Dozens of eyes snapped toward them. "You have forced yourself on the Duke's charity long enough. You have manipulated his sister's kindness to drag us all into this humiliating spectacle." "He pities you, Clara, and you are ruining Penelope's chances by making us look like grasping opportunists." The air rushed out of Clara's lungs. Her mother was sacrificing her. Mrs. Hayes had realized Arthur wasn't going to propose to Clara, and so she was publicly destroying Clara to prove she wasn't complicit, hoping to salvage Penelope's reputation for the lesser lords. "Eat or be eaten." Clara stood frozen. The whispers started, nasty hissing sounds echoing off the marble. Genevieve was smiling triumphantly. Clara looked at the faces around her. They were starving for blood. They wanted the wallflower pushed back into the mud. Clara lowered her head. The fight drained out of her, leaving only a hollow, echoing exhaustion. She had tried to play the game and she had lost. She turned to walk away. She just needed to find the stairs. She needed to get out into the cold street. A hand caught her wrist. It wasn't a painful grip. It was warm. It was bare. Clara gasped, looking down. Arthur Westing stood beside her. He had removed his right glove. His bare fingers were wrapped firmly around the delicate pulse point of her wrist. The heat of his skin against hers sent a violent shockwave up her arm. He didn't look at Clara. He looked at Mrs. Hayes. The silence in the corridor turned into a vacuum. No one breathed. "Mrs. Hayes," Arthur said. His voice wasn't raised. It didn't need to be. It possessed the terrifying quiet rumble of an impending avalanche. "You are causing a scene. I abhor scenes." Mrs. Hayes faltered, her face draining of blood. "Your Grace, I was merely correcting my daughter's delusions. We know she has imposed upon you. The only person imposing upon me is you, madam." Arthur cut her off. His grey eyes were black with rage. "You speak of manipulation. You speak of grasping opportunists. You are projecting your own rotting ambitions onto a woman who possesses more dignity in her little finger than you have accumulated in your entire miserable life." Mrs. Hayes took a physical step back, trembling violently. Arthur turned his gaze to Lady Genevieve. The debutante shrank against the pillar, the triumphant smile dying on her lips. "And you," Arthur said softly. "If I ever hear you speak to Miss Hayes in that tone again, I will personally buy the debts of your father's estate and evict you onto the street. Do we have an understanding?" Genevieve nodded frantically, tears of pure terror spilling over her powdered cheeks. Arthur didn't wait for a verbal response. He shifted his grip from Clara's wrist, sliding his bare hand down to interlace his fingers perfectly with hers. He didn't let her hide. He pulled her flush against his side, his arm wrapping securely around her waist. "Come, Clara," he said, his voice entirely different now, soft, grounding. "The air out here is toxic." He turned and walked her away. The crowd parted for them, parting so widely they pressed themselves against the walls to avoid the blast radius of the Duke's fury. Arthur didn't lead her back to the box. He led her down a narrow, dimly lit service corridor reserved for the theatre staff. He didn't stop until they were completely alone, surrounded by stacked velvet curtains and smelling of dust and lamp oil. He dropped her hand and stepped back. He ran a hand over his face, breathing heavily, the pristine illusion of his calm completely shattered. Clara leaned against a brick wall, her legs shaking so violently she thought she might collapse. "You shouldn't have done that," Arthur snapped his head up. "I should have let them tear you apart." "It was our arrangement," Clara cried out, her voice cracking. "I am the shield. They attack me, not you. You broke the rules. You made it real. Now they will never leave you alone because they know you actually care." The words echoed in the dusty corridor. Arthur went completely still. He looked at her, his chest rising and falling in the dim light. "Yes," Arthur said quietly. "They do know that now." Clara swallowed hard, tears finally pricking the corners of her eyes. "Why did you do it, Arthur? You ruined your own barricade." Arthur closed the distance between them in two long strides. He didn't grab her, but he stood so close she could feel the heat radiating off his body. He looked down at her unremarkable face, her muddy brown hair, her weak tea eyes. "Because I realized something profoundly irritating during the second act," Arthur whispered, his voice rough. "What?" Clara breathed. Arthur reached up. His bare hand traced the line of her jaw, his thumb brushing away a single tear that had escaped down her cheek. The touch was agonizingly gentle. "I realized," he said, his eyes dropping to her mouth, "that I no longer want peace, Clara. I want you." The smell of boiled cabbage was particularly potent the next morning. Clara sat at the small mahogany table, staring at the peeling wallpaper. She hadn't slept. Every time she closed her eyes, she felt the ghost of Arthur's bare thumb against her jawline. After his confession in the corridor, he had simply escorted her home in silence, leaving her at the door with a look that stripped her bare. The house was dead quiet. Mrs. Hayes had locked herself in her bedroom, mortified and terrified of the social ruin she had brought upon herself. Penelope was upstairs packing a small trunk, weeping softly. A heavy, authoritative knock rattled the front door. Clara didn't wait for the maid. She stood up, her joints aching, and walked to the door herself. She pulled it open. Arthur stood on the crumbling stoop. He wasn't wearing his impeccably tailored riding coat or his severe evening wear. He wore a plain black wool jacket, looking slightly rumpled, as if he hadn't slept either. In his left hand, he held a thick, leather-bound ledger. He walked past her without waiting for an invitation, stepping into the narrow, dark hallway. He stopped, sniffing the air. "Cabbage," Arthur noted flatly. "It's Thursday," Clara said, closing the door. "We always have cabbage on Thursday." Arthur turned to face her. He looked completely out of place in the dingy hallway, a wolf trapped in a mouse hole. He held up the ledger. "Do you know what this is?" he asked. "Your accounts," Clara guessed, exhausted. "It is a detailed inventory of the unentailed Westing properties. The ones I control directly, not the Crown." He tossed the heavy book onto a rickety side table. It landed with a thud that shook a small dusty mirror on the wall. "There is a townhouse in Bath. It is quiet. It has a very large garden, no drafts, and absolutely no cabbage." Clara stared at the ledger, her heart beginning a slow, heavy pounding against her ribs. "Why are you telling me this?" "Because," Arthur said, taking a step toward her, "I am buying it for Penelope." Clara's head snapped up. "What?" "I am buying it for Penelope and your mother." Arthur clarified, his face entirely serious. "I am setting up a trust that will guarantee them a very comfortable, very isolated living in Bath. Far away from London. Far away from you. Your sister will have a decent dowry, and your mother will have enough money to host terrible tea parties for the rest of her life, provided she never sets foot in Mayfair again." Clara opened her mouth, but no sound came out. He was systematically dismantling every chain that bound her to her miserable life. He was buying her freedom. "And me," Clara finally managed to whisper. "Where do I go?" Arthur stopped directly in front of her. He looked down the severe lines of his face, softening into something incredibly vulnerable. The cynic was gone. The Duke was gone. He was just a man standing in a draughty hallway, offering everything he had. "You do not go anywhere," Arthur said softly. "You stay with me." Clara backed up until her shoulders hit the wall. "As your mistress, you buy my family off and keep me in a townhouse in Mayfair. Do not insult me." Arthur snapped a flash of his old irritation returning. He reached out, resting his hands flat against the wall on either side of her head, caging her in. "I am not looking for a mistress, Clara. I am looking for a wife." The word hit her like a physical blow. A wife. The Duke of Ashbourne. The Wallflower. "Arthur, you can't..." Clara breathed panic, welling up. "They will destroy you. The Tun. They will say I trapped you. They will say I compromised you. You will be a laughingstock for marrying a penniless, unremarkable spinster." "I do not care about the Tun," Arthur said fiercely, his face inches from hers. "I care about the woman who looked at me in a crowded ballroom and saw a miserable man. I care about the woman who refused to cower when I mocked her. I care about the woman who is fiercely loyal to a sister who outshines her and who wears a hideous coat with more dignity than the Queen wears her crown." He leaned closer, his forehead resting gently against hers. The scent of sandalwood and cold air wrapped around her, erasing the smell of dust and cabbage. "Our arrangement was a barricade." Arthur whispered, his breath warm against her lips. "I wanted to keep the world out. But you dismantled it, Clara. You dismantled me. I do not want to be untouched anymore. I want to be ruined by you." Clara closed her eyes. The exhaustion, the years of hiding, the bitter certainty that she was unlovable, it all shattered. He wasn't a prince rescuing her. He was a tired, cynical man asking for a partner in the trenches. She opened her eyes. She looked into his pale grey ones. "I don't dance," Clara said softly, her voice trembling with the ghost of a smile. Arthur's mouth curved into a real full smile. It was a beautiful, devastating sight. "I know," Arthur murmured, sliding his hand from the wall to cup the back of her neck. "I will simply have to carry you." He kissed her. It wasn't polite. It wasn't tentative. It was a claiming deep, grounded and desperate. Clara kissed him back entirely, visible, entirely seen, stepping out of the shadows and permanently into the light. Sometimes the grandest romances don't start with a fairy tale. They start with mutual exhaustion. Clara and Arthur didn't need a perfect, happily ever after. They just needed someone willing to stand beside them in the trenches of a ruthless society, seeing the reality instead of the illusion. If this grounded, cynical take on the ballroom romance hit home for you, don't let the story end here. Hit that like button to show your support. Share this video with fellow romance lovers who prefer their historical dramas with a dose of brutal honesty, and make sure to subscribe to the channel for more deeply human stories. See you next time.